This is a brave new world. We'll see what, how this goes. We've got some new technology. Hope we're projecting well enough. Let us know if we don't. But anyway, Nicole's going to give us a little tutorial on all this. So, Nicole, you want to do that?
Sure. For those on the Zoom and those in person here, you're going to need to use your public speaking voice. We've got a tripod set up in the middle of the room with what's called an owl camera on it. And the camera will rotate 360 degrees to focus on whoever's speaking. There's a little bit of a delay. And it also will act as the speaker, so both the microphone and the speaker. We don't have the room speakers on because what happens is it creates a feedback loop. The owl will start getting this whine. So, commissioners, you're probably familiar with this from Wakuda, it's the same one that they use. We've turned off the panoramic view because you don't need to see the whole panorama back here. It gives us more space if we can just see what the cameras are on. So, what I'm going to ask is, if anybody who's on the Zoom, since we're kind of test running this for the first time today in a live format, if you can't hear something or you have any technical difficulties, please enter it into the chat. If you want to make public comment during one of the public comment periods, use the raise hand function and we will call on you. Anybody have any questions?
Are we going to be able to see the raised hand?
We will be able to see the raised hand, and right now people have their videos off so that we wouldn't be able to have, if there were people with video on, you'd see the gallery view. But otherwise, there's a little hand that comes up that we'll be able to see and call on.
Okay, in case I don't see it, would you help?
Yes, and you, if it's time for public comment, you can look it up and we'll say, yes, we have somebody with their hand raised.
Sounds excellent. Thank you very much, Nicole. Okay, so our first order of business is to approve the consent agenda. We've got six items on there which have been provided previously. So, any comments, questions about the consent agenda?
Well, there was a misprint on the item F. It originally appeared as $10,000 and not $10 million.
Yeah. So item F now is 10 million, let's be correct if I'm not agenda. The agenda that went out previously and said 10,000, is that correct? I like 10 million.
Yeah.
And the other thing is we're going to have a substitution for the presentation and invitation to bid for the fourth substation that Mike Hill's out of town. So that's going to be Doug Adams.
I move we approve the consent agenda.
I'll second that motion.
Been moved and seconded to accept the consent agenda for Okay, thank you. April 11, 2022. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Consent agenda for 2022 is approved.
Thanks for the nice pens.
Well, the signing is going to make for a longer meeting.
A year and a half on the board, and this is my first in-person meeting.
I'm about time to show up.
These last 2 years have been strange. Let's hope it doesn't go to 3 years.
This is just like at home. My wife gives me the checks and I just have to sign for the blank check.
Am I sure? Okay, any other agenda revisions, Sean?
Yeah, you already touched on one of them. So Mike Hill's out of town, so Doug Adams is going to fill in for item 5A on the agenda. And then we're going to add an item D to staff reports for mutual aid assistance provided to Calistone.
That's where's that? Item D?
Eight. Staff
okay, thank you. All right, comments from the public. Okay, this will be a trial run. Let's see how it goes. If you raise your hand, you'll see it here.
You don't hand raise.
Okay, thank you. So moving on to business items. First item is an invitation to bid number 220805. For the Fork substation, Doug.
Great. I'm Doug Adams. I'm the transmission and substation supervisor, and I'm recommending that we solicit bids to rebuild the Fork substation. And my current estimate for the project is at $547,080.
Does that include tax or not?
No.
It does not. And so we've identified the components that need to be replaced already. Is it right? Are we going to test and then decide or what?
Pretty much everything except for the transformer, which we did replace a few summers ago, is currently being soldered as I am. It's not a normal life of about 30-ish years, so we're good 20 years off that.
Questions, comments, motion?
I move that we solicit bids for the redo of the Fork substation, bid number 220805.
I'll second.
Moved and seconded to authorize solicitation of formal bids for bid number 220805 via the National Daily News or such other means as determined by staff and approved, inviting sale proposals from three qualified contractors for the replacement of aging equipment at Fork substation. The substation is located at 441 West East Spring Fork, Washington. The engineer's estimate for the project is $547,080, not including the Washington State sales tax. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Next slide. Okay, our next item is resolution 2236-22, adopting the 2022 schedule of deposits and charges. And electric line extension unit prices in the same resolution 2196-21. Travis?
Hey, you're right. Good to see you guys in person.
Yeah, it's good to be seeing.
So I'm recommending that we adopt the 2022 schedule of deposits and charges and electric line extension unit prices and rescind the previous. You guys should have a red line version of that document. We did post this as a news item on the website for public comment review. I do not believe we have any comment, at least not that I've seen on that item thus far.
Okay.
benefits costs, performance services, and material costs when it comes to construction. We did clean up some of the language too that was a little confusing as it relates to CC three-phase transformer connects and disconnects. We had to make some adjustments as well for our new hours. So operating hours change, therefore some of those charges that we collect for services rendered at the end of the day or after hours need to be changed to reflect that as well.
The transformer installation costs went up a bit more than others. Is that because of supply line problems?
I believe primarily. I know speak better to that because do most of the electric charges.
That's correct.
It's inflation.
Yeah.
So I noticed it's interesting the schedule 40 HVC pipe to 4-inch was, all the rest of it kind of went up like inflation, and that was almost three times the price of the previous cost that was there.
Was that primarily related to the cost increase or depletion of our existing inventory? So most of our inventory is weighted, so if we had a large supply that we bought several years ago at a lower cost, we bought, some recently, those costs are kind of averaged together, right? So if we have a surplus of inventory we overbought in years past, sometimes it takes a while to catch up as we have to use up basically the inventory that we purchased at a lower price before you see that big jump. I'm not sure if we're going to see it for a straight cost increase or
a cost increase and surplus.
A little bit of both. So.
Yeah, thank you. I noticed on the net meter installation of item C, 5.01 kW to 20 megawatts. Is that correct? That would be a solar inflation below it. That's under the net meter installation, I see. It goes up to 20 megawatts. That's the generator.
Yeah, that's unchanged from last year, so
that's the way it was. The cost of bridge will come to this, I guess. Any other questions, comments?
No. I move that we adopt resolution 2236.22 adopting the 2022 schedule of deposits and charges and electric line extension unit prices and rescinding resolution 2196-21.
I'll second the motion.
Thank you. It's been moved and seconded to approve resolution 2236-22. Adopting the 2022 schedule of deposits and charges and electric line extension unit prices and rescinding resolution 2196-21. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, our next item is acceptance memo completion bid number 211007. Charlie, you're up.
Yeah. Charlie with a security supervisor here. I'm sorry, facilities security deficit supervisor. This will be my last meeting. You guys don't know Katie Hunter is taking my position. I'm not retiring from this week. I believe she's online, but she couldn't make it here today. Future, she'll be presenting any of these surplus presentations.
Charlie, you're too young to retire.
I am.
Good. Get
it looks like the camera has no way on. So this is a memo for acceptance of bid 211007. This is for the completion of the skylight replacement at Central Warehouse Facility. Place 107 skylights by CHG Building Systems. It's been completed and is recommended this work be accepted as complete. The project consisted of all necessary services, labor, and materials required for skylight replacement at the Central Warehouse Facility. contract started the project on January 31st, 22, and completed the work on February 3rd, 22. The amount, including tax, is $121,128.32. They replaced exactly 107 skylights. They did a really good job doing that. If you do have time to go to the central warehouse and there is a four, you see there's a bit more light in there to replace with the skylights. So that would be acceptable.
Any change orders?
One
statement for still good. Questions or comments on this item?
No. I move that we accept minimal completion for bid number 211007.
I'll second that motion. The move and seconded to authorize district staff to approve acceptance memo completion of bid 211007. Contract with CHG Building Systems consists of necessary services, labor, materials required for skylight replacement in the central warehouse facility at 100 Hooker Road Square. And the total contract amount was $121,128.32, including Washington State sales tax. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. We got another one coming up.
I got another
one. Don't retire yet. The next item is Resolution 2237-22, authorizing the disposal of surplus property.
And this, hopefully you all got the list. It's a variety of different items. Mostly it's LED light, which we aren't, I'm sorry, it's the high-pressure sodium light that we aren't using anymore due to LED replacements. We are keeping a few on hand just in case there's customers that do not want LEDs, but primarily, this is going to pretty much get rid of that inventory. We've also got some aluminum USB cable on here, which, by the way, now is probably worth more than what we thought this back in 2003, just by recycling. And we also have some balls, which just have not been used anymore. We've gone with a different style ball, and these have been in inventory since 2013. We'd like to get all of these items put on govdeals.com. Me and you guys are interested in buying them. So we want the public to know that's going to be out there. And we want to try to recoup some of this money. Especially right now, it's good because things are pretty much worth more than what they are when we purchase them. That's how that works out in the bid process.
That would be true for high pressure sodium.
No,
paper, paper.
No, we got
it. I can't imagine better than four pills.
One of the last lots we got, we sold every one of them.
Really?
There's still a lot of old fashioned pot growers out there.
Yeah, I got a bunch of them. Okay, do comments, questions, or motions?
No questions. I move that Resolution 2237-22 authorizing the disposal of surplus property.
I'll second the motion. Okay, so moving seconded to approve Resolution 2237-22 authorizing the disposal of surplus property consisting of various old-style high-pressure sodium light fixtures, lamps, and related accessories with a total surplus value of $19,050. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you.
So this is your last meeting.
Not the city council.
Oh, well.
That doesn't count.
Well, we appreciate all the work you've done for the PUD.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. So, thanks.
And my turn.
Yeah, we got a mission for them. All right. We also have Resolution 2238-22 reestablishing dollar amounts for the working funds and descending Resolution 217420. You're not retiring, are
you? No.
You said sad about that.
No, I have nothing to start with me. Okay, so just a few things to note on the changes. We're changing the name for our change fund, which is the physical cash on hand at each office, to just working funds. The working fund we use to include the customer refund account, so we process all those refunds through the AP process now. So it is literally just the cash in the drawers and on hand. So to avoid confusion, we just want to rename it just working funds throughout the document. Second, we're eliminating petty cash, and we'll instead have all the small purchases made with the district credit card or reimbursed through the AP process. And the net effect with this resolution is a reduction of $150 to our overall cash on hand.
We have a resolution before us, resolution 2238-22. Questions, comments, motion?
I move that we accept resolution 2238-22, reestablishing the dollar amounts for the working funds and rescinding resolution 2174-20.
I second the motion. It's been moved and seconded to approve resolution 2238-22, reestablishing the dollar amounts for working funds and rescinding resolution 2174-20. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Okay, we have another resolution 2239-21, establishing the current electric service regulations and requirements, and rescinding resolution 2225-21.
Going.
Yeah, would you introduce yourself? I had trouble with that.
I'm going to have to ask Christian Clarence. I was going to
ask him. Thank you.
Everybody ask. You can come after. So we have had, you guys obviously seen the markup. So $50 charge, we have that in effect since 1984. So that is 38 years now. Back then, wire alone was $2 a foot installed. Today, especially because we just established the deposit charge $8.30 a foot. So we're just trying to adjust it to an even 200 to account for the 25 feet that it was available to do back in 1984. Today, if we left it $8.30 a foot, it's 6 feet. So as the construction and stuff going on, we're marking out for estimates, it's no longer relevant. Because we're doing a lot of accounts payable and a lot of receivable reconciliation for this effect. So
those are the only changes is just in this cost accounting.
Yep, right? Just the $50 limit.
Just, and that's, again, that's inflation or escalation cost.
Yep.
Okay. Questions, comments?
So, the one of our packages is filed?
Okay. Yeah, the one behind the red line.
Yeah, the red line is just the page 14.
Is this the red line?
No, it's the red line one says, down here it says red line.
Okay.
So the one, this paper book I believe is the red line.
I'm just wondering, this is the one I want to keep red line.
Yeah.
I'm moving to the accept resolution 2239-22, establishing the current electric service regulations and requirements for rescinding resolution 2225-21.
I second the motion.
moved and seconded to approve resolution 2239-22, establishing the current electric service regulations and requirements and rescinding resolution 2225-21. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. All the before you
all the slanders, it's Jim Orbeck. Sorry, Jim.
Yeah, an RFP that just needs Jim's signature as a secretary.
What's that?
I think there's one or two things in there that require only your signature.
Okay.
I think there's just one.
my ID, my internet, good
carpal
tunnel. Yeah, we can go right from here.
Let me know if I missed it. It'll trickle through. I figured out what was wrong. This thing is a button. I shouldn't turn it back. Very good, thank you. Our next item is the PPA post 2028 contract discussions, commissioners and staff. I think we're reaching a conclusion of this thing. We've got the concept paper written, it's been approved by PPC, and presented to Bonneville. Now we're waiting for rebuttal.
It's important to note that with the initial concept paper, we basically just looked at the low-hanging fruit. The second phase is when we talk about the potential for system augmentation is going to be much more contentious. And I'm personally hoping that we can convince Bonneville to have as much flexibility as possible. And, of course, we've been asking for a lot more flexibility than they wanted to give in the past. Historically, Bonneville has always considered their system as a single system. And if you wanted to do anything different, you could not do that. And clearly, now is the time for us to continue to push on that issue. And the system augmentation probably is going to be one of the biggest issues that Bonneville will push back on. At least I anticipate that they'll push back on it. In other words, what I'm trying to say is they'll want everyone to do the same thing, and I don't think that public power is going to go down that path. So I expect a lot of headbutting from this point forward.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with what you said, Rick, and I guess I got to be noted and won't have it noted in our discussions with them is this concept paper is basically just round one. And we've got a couple more years of head knocking, and so the public folks, you know, we need to stay engaged, and there's a lot. And the thing is, it's interesting because things are changing so quickly in the power markets that, you know, what we were talking about a year ago doesn't even seem right today.
Yeah.
And so we're going to see that a year from now when we scratch our head on, looking at all this work we, all this stuff we listened to in 2021 is now largely changed. And so we're going to have to be adaptable and really pay attention to what's going on, you know, whether it's, you know, climate change, the markets themselves, technology, renewables, cost of all this stuff, cost of
hydro,
cost of living, all this stuff is really tied up on us. So, yeah, that was, I guess, the 2028 stuff. That's most of my observations, too.
So they're going to have a public meeting on April the 21st. Bonneville speaking to them. And they're going to come out with a issue of their concept paper July the 1st. Now, you know, this change, more flexibility, Do you anticipate that they will still negotiate unique contracts with each utility, or are we going to see templates of bulk rate for just the block, splicing?
Well, my expectation is that Module is going to want templates. Yeah, I think Public Power is going to want unique contracts and hence the template.
Yeah, that's traditional. That's what Bob has done.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, part of it is just the complexity of this. A, B, this is what they did 20 years ago. And so, as I've listened to all these meetings, I'm not overly impressed with the integration among the staff components. So basically, you know, look across this thing and see the big picture in terms of what has changed. So what you see is the same, you know, a staffer basically reading the script from 20 years ago. And it just gets repeated in that meeting, and then another staffer, another meeting, go, wait a minute. So, you know, we're listening to this, and John and I talk about this, is, well, wait a minute, put these things together. And, you know, and think about it that way. And it concerns me because I think that unless we're really, the PUDs are really outspoken here, we're going to be on a train track that we can't get off of, and yet the world is changing around us.
There's another issue, I think, that hasn't been talked about a lot, but Bonneville is proposing to change the water years that they use for their analysis.
Contract high water mark.
Yeah. And it will affect the contract high water mark. Historically, what we've been doing, we've been using 1939 through 2018. Bonneville is proposing that we move to, let's see,
I adjust the parking chamber.
And one of the significant, and the argument for this is climate change. Okay, I can understand that. You know, maybe we get less water. But the interesting thing to me is that of the components for doing planning and studying, looking at firm energy and non-firm energy, that to me is the important element. And with this change, the FELCC goes up 3%. So tell me, someone comes to me and says, yeah, climate change, less water, we need to change the water years. Oh, that makes sense. But all of a sudden we're going to get 3% more firm energy? I don't know. There seems to be a disconnect between the goal and the result. Now, I agree, 3% is not a lot. But if we're thinking that we're going to get less water in the future, why would you adopt something that gives you more firm power? And, you know, I'm looking at this article that has been clearing up, and they quote Michael Dean and from EPC and saying, yeah, well, they're doing exactly what we asked for. And if that's what we asked for, we weren't precise enough, in my opinion. So I think that we, well, I don't know. If you think about the result of that, it would mean that Bonneville would potentially be out in the market. Now, we're a full requirements customer, so we would be, Bonneville will be out in the market for us either way, and getting more firm power, I think, probably in the long run is good for us. But I still sometimes question the logic when, you know, you say, you know, you're making a change, you know, to reflect the less water that you're getting, and the result is you get more firm power. There's something just doesn't feel right about that.
Well, that's a classic example of what I'm talking about. It's this whole initiative, you know, with PPC and Phoenix. Let's look at a 30-year rolling average. Okay, fine. When you do that, you leave off some of that water years. You end up with more, quote, water, therefore more that 3%. But, like you're saying, wait a minute. What things are changing, and notably the climate. And so, Yeah, that's a classic example of what we're going to be facing here is we're in this sort of long-term thinking methodology when in fact we're in a short-term, world of changing factors and assumptions and stuff like that. So
that water board should fix that allocation. Are you building any flexibility into that because these projections are forecasts?
I haven't seen any thing that could discuss any kind of flexibilities or alternatives or how to deal with it. John, I was wondering if you had any thoughts on this.
So basically, my thinking is when they talk contract high watermarks, they're still looking at the accounting construct between tier one and tier two. It's somewhat arbitrary. Now, what it means to us is a low-quality utility when they raise, let's say, 3%. What that means is we will generally be given more firm power on the accounting side and less power on the market or two side. But it doesn't change the likelihood that it may not be that water level and they may have to go on the market more than they anticipate. So it's not a resource adequacy type of deal. And it's generally beneficial for us for a higher contract high water mark, but we believe we'll be less exposed to high market prices over the next years ahead. What it really means is BPA on average in most years will sell less secondary sales and withhold more of that for their customers. But there will be points in time for adverse water years that it doesn't really matter to have to go back on the market to get more, even though it's, quote, tier one from an accounting standpoint and what they charge customers.
So does that mean, John, that if they have to go into the market to supplement, and let's say the market's very high, then, and they're already set to sell that at a lower price, so it seems like a financial disconnect.
And what it most certainly is. So basically, they have to cost that out. So by raising contract on word marks, they're going to consider that they will have to go into the market more. And they will probably consider the volatility of the market today, which is almost unique, and we're going to see it here in the next rate case, where tier two is dramatically higher potentially than tier one. And they will have to build that uncertainty. But basically, we're going to check their cash flows at some point in the future that will have to be moved. Just like if they have a half a dozen pool water years in a row, that's going to have impact on rate cases in the future.
Since we're talking about that BPA hydro forecast, which is always pretty substantial, one there is, and that. I'll bring that up now because the other thing they talk about is what the outlook is going to be with climate change. And what they're basically saying is that we're going to, have the big change is going to be in the Snake River Basin where it's going to be warmer in the upper basin and drier. And it's interesting that there may be more precipitation in the winter, but it's going to be drier in the summer, so that's not good news for projects in the state place.
I think that makes it more need for the projects in the Snake Basin.
They're just going to have less power.
Yes, but the water is also used for irrigation and transportation, so having that water behind the dams will allow for that to continue.
No, that doesn't change.
I didn't read it.
Anyway, that was another point that they brought out there.
It sounds like it would be more market purchases, which is unspecified resources, which traditionally is carried or partly. So has that been discussed?
I haven't heard anyone talking. I have heard some people making it clear to Bonneville that they want a zero carbon product.
And I've heard lots of customers saying that, you know, that's what they want. I certainly have not heard any change from Bonneville. I mean, historically, what I've always heard from Bonneville was that, hey, there are times we have to go out and make purchases. We don't know what the carbon content of that is, and we cannot, as I understand it, guarantee you that you're getting 100% carbon-free.
So Bonneville customers would have to eat the penalties of using the product.
Unless we can convince them to set aside, you know, for some customers, that's what we
need. Yes, indeed. Yes.
Yeah, and I believe, based on the discussions over the last year and a half, Bonneville may come back and actually try to provide, at least over the term of the contract, and approach the feeder requirement for 100% of non-emitting no carbon in 2045 to try to facilitate that, but they're going to create two potential products. And I doubt that they'll be able to do that at the onset of the 2028 contract. There's not a non-carbon market available to go out and buy.
You know, it's funny. I sent an email to the folks that are WECC that monitor them, and this was about 6 months ago or so. Currently, anytime you buy power, there's a tag. Okay, and the tag lists the generator, then the purchase selling entity, and then all the entities that goes to the transmission provider, and then the customer. And in that tag, you have to declare whether the generation is firm or non-firm. You have to, there's like two other things that you have to declare. And my suggestion was, hey, let's add a carbon or non-carbon to each tag so that it would assist customers in the state of Washington, for example, and it would get rid of Bonneville's excuse that they can't differentiate whether the power is green or not. If you had added that to the tag, then that would be transparent. And then that would make it easier for Bonneville to do so. I never heard back from them. That sounds a good idea.
Well, it's almost necessary.
You would somehow, there's going to have to be some way of tagging the energy in the future. And I think the sooner that we get there, the better.
Is there any discussion of continuing to use RECs or meeting these requirements?
I haven't heard anything. Have you heard anything
about what RECs are?
No. I mean, they've mentioned it a couple times, but I really don't know where. What did I mean?
Well, he was thinking of using a REC to offset carbon, kind of heat seed up in some respect. But anyway, let's see.
Yeah, well, they allow up to 20% RECs. As long as the supply doesn't exceed 20% carbon, they can be mitigated between 2030 and 2044 with RECs. So if our carbon supply through EPA were, let's say, 10%, and the fact that we buy a certain number of IEA or Energy Independence Act RECs, 15%, we can apply those, at least we believe, and allow us to apply those RECs to our carbon from VPN, which makes it very likely, so long as our carbon portion from VPN supply will exceed, let's say, 14-15%, that we will meet the definition of carbon neutrality after 2030. Right now, we meet the definition of carbon neutrality now under the terms of CEPA. Because about 15% renewable energy credits that were not applied to hydro under the Energy Independence Act.
So something else is going to throw a monkey wrench into all of this.
Absolutely.
It's, you know, the Environmental Protection Agency has not updated their emissions, I guess, formulas for plants since 2001, 20-something years ago. And so they're in the process of doing that. And one of the things they're obviously looking at is methane emissions from reservoirs, because that's the source of global warming gases. And so when they do that and input that, all of a sudden, in hydro projects are all different based on the kind of water they get and their temperatures and depths and all that kind of stuff. But if we look at them as these dams, we're going to have to face with, wow, that's not carbon neutral. That's got a price tag on it, and so we're going to have to, you know, adjust to that too. So it's going to make this whole argument about, you know, green hydropower being part of the grid kind of a whole new dialogue.
Yeah, and there was a recent Supreme Court case where EPA does have a little collection of green hydropower.
Yeah.
So, just one thing, I'm going to be quiet, but I was EIM, and, you know, it sounds very much like we're trucking towards an RTO. So how does that impact all this? You know, just something to think about.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we're only using spare time.
Well, that's a small topic. We'll move on.
Okay, anything else on that from staff or commission?
Not for me.
All right, we'll move on to correspondence communications. Sean, I think you have an item.
Yeah, we got a nice letter from NWPPA last week. I'm just going to read the first paragraph here. It says, "It is my pleasure to announce that the Northwest Public Power Association's Award Committee has named Doug Nass as recipient of its Life Leadership Award for 2022. This award is presented to member system policymakers or managers who have recently retired or will be retiring in 2022 and have made notable contributions to the Association of Public Power. We are honored to present Doug with this award for his many years of work with Palm County PUD and in the industry." So their plan is to present this award to Doug at the NWPPA annual meeting in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, which is on May 22nd and 25th. As you know, Doug will no longer be an employee of the district then, so just getting commission approval to send Doug to that event so that he can receive his award on behalf of the district.
Yeah, I think it's a well-deserved award. I think we should support it. So, thoughts?
That's great.
Okay, good.
Yeah, we need a motion, or as long as you guys are all okay with that, I will inform Doug and kind of get ahead of it for the event.
I see three nods, so I think we're good.
All right.
Anything else to do, sir?
No, that was it. Thank you.
Okay, we'll move on to commissioner reports. Jim, we're going to lead it
off. Yeah, let's see. There was a Laguna meeting right after our last meeting, about a month ago. I guess I made a couple comments in the round table about our 4-day work week implementation. Also pointed out that I asked John Harrison, the BPA administrator, about raising the 200 kilowatt new resource limit for interconnection studies and asked him to raise that to 1 or 2 megawatts. I had to ask three times before the staff actually realized I was making a request.
Yeah.
They just simply couldn't conceive of that. So anyway, we'll see what happens with that. I listened to listened in on the energy and the education roundtable. Not a whole lot there. Maybe Rick has more. I've really covered all that. The Economic Development Council had a meeting too. It was mostly procedural, although most of the discussion was taken up was transfer station and Carlsberg. So. Big ticket item for us.
The Energy Committee meeting talked about the legislature and the very
been passed, with 100 billion. Do you have any idea what percentage of our arrears that this that we'll get coverage for?
I don't, because the law that was passed only allows money to be distributed to low income customers, and the amount of arrears that we have, I'm not sure how to tell what percentage you actually meet the criteria. We did get the grant from the county, the ARPA money that was $350,000. We've applied just over $250,000 of that, so we've got 100 left that we're working on getting distributed, but our arrears have come down substantially.
But overall, the 100 million doesn't cover the arrears that we have
in the state.
In the state,
yeah. No, I agree. That's why I was curious as to what our state
of otherwise that we get.
Let's see, there was community solar projects. My understanding is there's an issue. This is House Bill 1814. There's some issue with the bondable contracts. John, are you aware of any issue there with that?
No, not. You talk about the low income community solar, hoping all the agencies that might do that.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, technically, I guess if it goes above 200, so 200 kW, you could conceivably go into the line load of aircraft evaluation, but I believe some of those are exempt, but I'm not sure.
Just someone had noted that or said that, and I just jotted it down. There was a lot of bills addressing Washington residents' risk of rolling blackouts, House Bill 1623, House Bill 1812, modernize the energy facility site evaluation council to state clean energy goals, State Bill 5722, existing building performance standards, which I think we've heard a little bit about that. House Bill 1663, reduce methane emissions from landfills. Unless you somehow pass that, I know there are methane burners that people put together. I don't know what else you would do. Let's burn it off. House Bill 1913, hydro licensing funding. Senate Bill 5842, state laws that address climate change. So as you can see, the legislature was quite busy on making sure that we knew that they're around. During the WAPAC meeting, there was some discussion about electric vehicles. John had already done a study. So basically, this is at Waputa. And the question being asked was, are our members' systems sound enough to deal with the increased load that will be brought about by electric vehicles? But I had to touch base with John to have him remind me. He had already done a study, and he expects, I think, in over a 25-year period, that our loads will increase about 28%.
For kilowatts.
On the energy.
Actual energy. And our loads for system demand, considerably less. But still substantial. Now, fortunately, because we're winter peaking in the morning, it will impact us, electric vehicles in our area, assuming mostly at home charging, will be much less onerous than most of the other utilities in Washington, and definitely less onerous than some of the peaking utilities in the Southeast.
And do you think it's my expectation, and I could be wrong here, but as electric vehicles start penetrating the market more, I would expect that a lot of businesses would be putting in chargers as well.
Well, as a matter of fact, the state, electric phase in Washington actually requires, as part of permitting, allocation for electrical vehicle chargers at new locations. So, they install the electric systems. to make charges available. Now, at words or at shopping centers is not particularly, there would have to be some, but that is not a very beneficial consideration for us because of where it puts the peak load in charging. It's disadvantageous as far as more infrastructure to accommodate charging that's not done in the evening at 38 hours. So it would considerably increase our morning peak if it were that one charged. Organizations do that, they'll have to do it. Hopefully, most people in our area will take care of charging at home. But that's what I suspect.
I went back and reviewed the presentation. It was about a year ago, I think, or so, that he made that. And I have a request that he wanted the other commissioners to back me up on. I would like John to not give the whole presentation again, but at the end of the presentation, you had a number of recommendations that you suggested, and this was over a year ago, and I would like us to have you to talk about what your recommendations have been to see whether we're heading in the right direction to accommodate that new load growth that we anticipate.
Sounds prudent to me.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, it's good to update something like that because things are changing so quickly. I think, you know, another aspect of this to look at PDVs is their batteries on wheels, essentially. And so at some point, I know this Ford has already doing this, and they're marketing because I order a light. They send me shit all the time. The fact is that these EVs, if managed or built into the grid with smart devices, AMI meters, and stuff like this, actually could help us deal with some peak load issues and stuff like that. Or outages. I mean, it would have been pretty nice if, you know, if I had an EV last week when the power was off for 10 hours.
But I think that's a great idea. I think what you're saying is use the EV batteries to help supplement our system when we have outages. Wouldn't we have to have some type of agreement with our customer to make that happen?
Well, absolutely.
That's what we got. That's
basically, we looked at that. And that we had a smart presentation a couple years ago, and we actually pointed out the potential of EVs in a net metering configuration actually providing support during peak times. Now, if it's under a net metering configuration, it cannot be used as an emergency generator unless it's disconnected from the system, which is feasible. But there's definitely, within the industry over the last 3 years, there's been discussion about using electric vehicle batteries for discharging onto the system in a net metering configuration opportunistically, as long as the return or the payment to the customers for that function and the control system necessary. We already have some hardware lined out that would allow us to do that for managed computer AMI. It could conceivably work beneficially for both us and the customer. Although, at this point in time, I think the customer would generally lose on the degradation of the batteries, unless it was done in a very controlled way when we know the need.
I was thinking about how does that work. You know, if I come out in the morning and I need to go somewhere and my battery's dead because there's been an outage and they use my battery to supply my neighbor's house.
Well, those are the situations you have to take care of. It would have to be basically a special agreement over beyond the net meter interconnect agreement that basically the customer would allow us to utilize the battery under certain conditions, very cold temperatures, winter time between a couple hours where we have a potential resource inadequacy or just extremely high cost. And we like we're in a, let's say, a, we call it the tires, the distribution, where they control their equipment based on our needs.
The
band response. So it would be very similar to a demand response. So let's say the customers allow us to control hot water heaters during certain intervals. It would be something more advanced than that, but we could simply do the same thing for a relay device, integrated with our AMI meter system, that would allow customers to participate. But you are correct, if they did participate, and we did use their battery, it would be discharged. Just having a case to be tested with the customer, if they expect to utilize the vehicle to take a long trip right after you discharge the battery. All that needs to be understood and open up with the customer.
Have you thought about the timing on when we need to start thinking about a pilot program or start heading down that path so that we don't get caught unaware?
We're already essentially working on that now, a demand response. We like to do a demand response to mitigate EPA demand charges. And once we do that, it will be very easy for somebody with an EV that wants to participate on actually generating. We could use the same parameters, cost parameters for that, to apply the EVs. And we've been talking about time of use range and demand response for a couple of years now. And I would think in the next 2 years, we should have a pilot project. The hardware is available. We've implemented AMI for close to 8,500 customers. For those customers, it would be effective. But it would require customer investment, rebates from us, and an agreement on how it's to be done. The hardware has a user interface, Landspear has a user interface for the customer and the utility. They go in and check the boxes, voluntary, own part. But we have to be able to give signals for demand levels, which we are susceptible to demand charge. It would have to happen several times a month in the winter months, even more in the summer months, during heat waves. They would tell us that, hey, we have a zero risk of demand charge for DPA being allocated. Customer participates. Anything we shave off of our demand charge, we would return to the customer. Minus our administrator. The conception we have is a matter of resources and action over territory. Probably start a pilot project with a dozen, a couple dozen participants.
I have one more thing. Yep. I'm thinking about transmission outages that we have for Bonneville, and I know that every time we have discussed the issue with Bonneville, we get a lot of pushback. And, you know, having to wait for their crews to come up from Olympia causes a lot of delay. And I was thinking maybe a first or a different approach that we might take would be to reach out to Bonneville and let's ask them to provide us with the outage times by utility for their customers. At the end of the day, we're paying the same transmission rate as every other customer. However, we're getting significantly worse service than other customers. And I think that if we at least can demonstrate that to Bonneville, maybe it would be it's a different approach. I don't think, at least I'm not aware of us having made that approach in the past. It seems like every other approach we've made, we've been getting a consistent feedback, which is no. But maybe if we can demonstrate that up on the peninsula, the utilities, Jefferson House and Port Angeles, that we're getting much poorer service, maybe that would be useful leverage. I don't know.
Maybe you can make that clear.
Yeah. And I think that's, with that, I think I'm done.
Okay, thank you. Just a couple on that Bonneville travel time from the Olympia to the Havages. I think we explored this with Bonneville before. Find the source of the outage so that their crew got there and goes right to that location. I don't know how effective that's been, but Bonneville's pretty independent, so they might just.
Yeah, once we know that there's an outage on their line, our guys are out patrolling the line, trying to find it.
And Bonneville takes that information and uses it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If we ever explored maybe training PUD linemen to work on the Bonneville system, we should just hire voltage.
Yeah, John, you have to answer that. We've looked into that, but I think we can't touch their lines.
Well, yeah, we do have authorization to work on BPA lines, at least on the 115 section to the west of Port Angeles. But there's a lot of, there has to be a countdown emergency where they can't respond. Now, OSHA implemented in 2014 and Washington in 2016 adopted some new requirements on information transfer requirements. It requires BPA prior to a contractor or us working on the lines to convey current status of the system and a lot of check boxes for information that has to be provided per occasion. Now, when your contractor is pretty easy, you get the information start to work for days on end. But for us, we have to do that each and every time there's an outage. And the time it takes to convey that information effectively, it will exceed the most of the travel time it takes there for an emergency manager. So that's a pretty high hurdle.
Well, let's just keep working that issue.
Yeah.
On the legislative items, this wasn't discussed in the Energy Committee, but you know, there was a number of bills that went to Governor Inslee's desk requiring Commerce Department to look at system reliability and resiliency under CETA. They're the rules for CETA has an effect that they're supposed to do an annual study. Sounded very reasonable, but Governor Inslee vetoed those bills. He felt they were done. So. A number of items, we talked about WAPAG. I think we talked about Wakuda. I attended a Eco Safety Review Board meeting at Energy Northwest. Actually, caught the last day. We're bringing this panel of experts as they explain their findings and give us accolades. I'm not sure what else they give us, but anyway, but they gave us pretty positive. Schools and everything, so that was good. And they went through what items they talked about and explained areas of improvement and so on. We also had a resource advocacy task force meeting and talked about the agreements with Grant County for the small modular reactor. That's moving along, but Grant's board seems to be inclined not to put this on site one, which is on Hanford. It's been licensed for nuclear activity with the Brooklyn City District installed in Grant County, so they get the economic benefits of it. Now, there's a downside to that. They don't have qualified people to operate a nuclear reactor, so don't know how that fits. But the other piece of that is the cost of transmission to get it from site one on Panther 2, the Grand Valley. Opportunity came up here in the resource adequacy for small modular reactor. The vitrification plant on Panther uses a tremendous amount of fuel, and they vitrify nuclear waste, so obviously there's a lot of energy. They're presently using fuel oil and diesel to fire boilers to produce that. And so it's just a constant stream of trucks going into that, or will be going into that plant. Unclear how that's going to play with the state as far as carbon emissions. So what we're doing, we're trying to gauge Department of Energy on installing a small modular reactor
So far, I've been mixed reaction to that, but I think as we get further into this, there may be an opportunity to do that there. I think I talked about the last time about the halo, zero, high assay, low enriched uranium required for the small modular reactors. They're opening a plant, I think it's in South Carolina, not to produce that fuel, but to use that fuel to produce fuel specifically for a small modular reactor design. It's still dependent on Russia, but the Department of Energy is actually starting on a plant in Oak Ridge to produce that payload fuel, which is critical to the small modular reactor. The Russian thing, which kind of surprised me, I guess 20 to 25% of nuclear fuel used in this country comes from Russia. And so I guess the question came up, how does that impact Colombia? And the response is we have been very fortunate in the proactive purchasing fuel. We've got supply on hand that lasts through early 2030s. So that's a good thing. The we talked about the EPU, that's the Enhanced Power Upgrade of Columbia. And we're having ongoing discussions with Bonneville about that. And he seems to be getting more interested. It's a big dollar item. It will take probably up to 10 years to implement, but it's going to be staged. And that would produce more power, which coming from Columbia would be tier one. So that sounds like an easy sell, but we'll see how it goes.
What will it cost? I mean, per megawatt hour?
Well, I can't do the list to take my head, but it's $600 million.
It's what?
$600 million.
Yeah, I saw that. I'm trying to translate that. So, is it, you know?
Well, we're going to get, it depends on which. There are different versions of this EPU. It's up to 200 plus megawatts we can get on the plant for that. This, of course, this has to be done with the license extension of the plant. So you're looking at 30 years of 200 plus megawatts in that one village. It pays out as far as the financial pays out. Got to convince all of it. What else are we talking about here? I also went to the Economic Development Council Gala. That was great because it was in person. I saw a lot of old friends. None of us were aged at all. And they had an interesting speaker, the president of IFRS, the Plan House. Very dynamic speaker. Interesting how they have huge employee and customer loyalty. And he explained how to do that. So a lot of lessons learned from that. The we had an Energy Northwest executive board meeting. Actually, it was a combined meeting of board directors and executive board. And part of that was we approved a new bond issue of $600+ million. Part of that would go for the regional cooperation funding of buy down Bonneville's debt. And so that should flow. We've made the stipulation it has to flow directly to customer rates. And so that will help do that. Part of that meeting, it was brought in a number of experts on small modular reactor technology. We talked about sodium cooled small modular reactors like the TerraPower thing, it's Bill Gates' flavor. We talked about the X Energy, I took your gas cooled and all that, plus other designs that are out there. There's a number of designs in the US plus Europe. And so we kind of zeroed in on the I took your gas cooled X Energy model, and that's what Grant's interested in. But and we also have an agreement with TerraPower for their Wyoming project. Well, we have a memorable understanding. So anyway, that was interesting and very educational. It was great.
Outside of that, let's see, what else do we have? Let's go. Nothing to draw on. Let's take a 5-minute break. Go back here. Unless something out of our Energy Northwest report, you know, Evita, which is the part of Energy Northwest, installs charging stations. They are looking at installing charging stations on the 101 route around the peninsula, which would open up tourism out here for electric vehicles and so on. And they anticipate getting grants and doing that, so we'll see. Okay, we're moving on to staff reports. First one is conservation presentation with us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Turn out here.
Some slides here.
So I'm excited to start with them. The service supervisor here was responsible for our compensation efforts for energy efficiency, as I call it. So the energy efficiency conservation is sort of interchangeable. So that's right there. I'm just going to go over a quick quick overview of our efforts in the past couple of years. I'll start by talking about the 2020-21 combined year for the Energy Independence Act, which wrapped up, covered the compliance costs and some additional benefits associated with those efforts, and then give you a little outlook of the current CIA by 2022-23. For the start, for 2020-21, the EIA targets, I believe it was in December of 2019, the board adopted a target 6,833 megawatt hours. In general, the track is aimed to overshoot that target by about 20% because we can use any overage in future biennium, which gives us sort of a practical target, a strategic core target, we call it 8,200 megawatt hours for the biennium. We closed out last year saving 11,337. Megawatt hours, well over the targets. And out of that, about 1,300 is rollover from the prior planning, so that comes from overage of the 2019-18 that we applied to the first target. The color scheme is a little challenging, but I think about 4,200 megawatt hours comes from the NEAS, Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance, and their regional efforts, the savings that we get assigned to us, and then we can apply towards our target. And then 5,700 megawatt hours or so comes from direct programs that we run ourselves with local contractors and our customers. So one you know, major question I assume I address is the overage, how we go over the target so much. You know, and partially, it's really a big function is inertia. So the start at the top is the whole carry forward portion. You know, because we aim to go over the target a little bit, you know, we have historically, you know, gone over our target and achieved a lot of savings. So currently, we're not really pushing, paying very high savings or targets. Well, what's happening is we have long established relationships with our contractors, and just great interest in our programs from past efforts. So really, you know, we overshoot that target, frankly, in some ways by not trying very hard. Currently, rather just by having really good relationships with our customers and contractors. The other thing worth keeping in mind is when we establish a target, we actually always also establish a potential. So use, for instance, water heaters, for example. You know, we only have so many water heaters in our service territory. So in the process of looking at savings potential for those water heaters, we can't, you know, we're not, of course, going to replace those right away. Rather, it's an assumption that through our programs they'll be replaced over time. That's why we have the savings potential. So when we overshoot our target, potentially also what we're doing is we're reducing our potential in the future. not so much that we're just like getting those savings now, rather just we're getting those savings sooner than we otherwise would have done. And then also, the last point is just a continuation of the programs. You know, partially, the reason our programs are working so well is because we haven't run for a long time with strong relationships. You know, so in theory, we probably could do a better job of, you know, trying to hit the target exactly right, shutting the programs off, you know, stopping programs at the time. But as soon as we start doing that, we're going to have problems retaining the contractors. So hopefully, you know, appreciate the support and that for the efforts over so many years. You know, hopefully we'll continue to have that to keep those strong relationships with the contractors and our customers. In terms of cost, we're able to achieve the savings currently at very low cost. As a part of our strategic plan, we established a target of keeping the cost of our programs low. And for 2021, that was $46 per megawatt hours. And I believe that the value comes from sort of a proxy for tier two power. But our levelized cost of our compensation programs it came in for 2021 at about $20 per megawatt hours. And that's really, you know, for some of our more popular measures, which is really heat pumps, currently we're paying well below EPA's willingness to pay. We're paying well below actually the state of Angeles, the state of Wisconsin, with their incentives. In some ways, you know, we're really just paying contractors to tell us when they're installing the heat pumps, you know, that in return they get, be able to use us as a marketing tool for our efforts. So we get the savings currently very, very cheap. In addition to the energy savings, and I realize that system feed reductions and CO2 reduction isn't necessarily specific what we try to do, but we're required to report CO2 emissions as part of our fuel mix disclosures to the state. And it's pretty straightforward for me to tally those up, so I'd like to report those as well. So over the 2-year period, we reduced our system fees by about 1,500 kilowatt hours, and we reduced about 2,000 metric tons of CO2 through the energy efficiency efforts that we run. And the assumptions behind those comes from the regional technical forum and account for EPA numbers. The outlook for the future, so I included here a chart so you can see, so the targets that the board adopted here last year was 5,143 megawatt hours, and you know, so as you can see, the target is continuing to go down, you know, largely as a function of cheaper power prices. Power is cheap, conservation makes people address that sense, but also of course it's a function of overachieving. Every time we go over the target, and that is always going to be a lower target in the future. We'll be able to meet that target quite handily, largely through residential heat pump, industrial heat pump programs. Incidentally, the heat wave we had last summer had a, you know, showed a huge increase in our heat pump program. A lot of our customers are fairly interested in air conditioning right now because of the heat wave. And of course, that interest isn't necessarily the energy savings. The energy savings is just kind of a bonus for the customer. But nonetheless, you know, I've seen an increase in those efforts because of the heat wave. There's also a fair bit of potential commercial lighting that we're still going after converting to LED lighting, although that is rapidly diminishing, but we should see a fair amount of savings still at least for 2022-23. After which that will start fading a little bit. Also, smart thermostats, we're seeing them particularly because the heat pump brand Carrier has partnered with Nest thermostats on most Carrier heat pump installations now go along with the Nest thermostats. Heat pump water heaters, which is sort of the last, you know, big energy using appliance that we're promoting. You know, we've been trying for a few years to generate interest among our contractors, you know, but there's still a lot of skepticism from the contractors, partially because we're hitting the target so well, we're not really pushing so hard on the contractors to change their mind, but rather, you know, we're sort of letting the market slowly mature. You know, we still see a fair bit of heat pump water heaters, you know, compared to how many electrical systems tanks we have.
contractor skepticism. You know, I had my one way heater replaced a couple of weeks ago, and I talked to the contractor about it. Oh no, you don't want that. What's driving that?
Well, there's a few different things. You know, one was that GE had to pump water heater out the GE Hewitt Spring from 5 years, which was sort of the first unitary pump water heater that would hit the market, but there was some manufacturing defect that caused the problems. You know, and anytime you run into, you know, something new comes along and word gets out that it was problematic, you know, there, you know, get some cautions, you know, because really, you know, there's a difference in plumbers and heating contractors and how they sell the equipment. You know, generally heat pump contractors, you know, they have a long history of converting from electrical systems to heat pumps. So the energy efficiency sales process is kind of part of what they do when they have salesmen sell heat pumps, whereas plumbers generally aren't salesmen. You know, they're repairing the tank, it's emergency work. You know, the tank is out, we need hot water tomorrow, get it in, out. So they're not quite as used to and comfortable, you know, selling, trying to upsell a different piece of equipment. And then it's the fact, too, that there's refrigeration, you know, it's just a little different. Electrical systems, you know, there's no moving parts, really, you know, maybe some relay switches for the temperature control of the tank. So the fact that there is a compressor and fan of those cool air, and they generally don't have a refrigerant license to work on. So they, you know, it's just kind of new and different. You know, frankly, when we marketed heat pumps, or the ductless heat pumps, even to heating contractors many years ago, you know, when I first tried to push them, I had several local companies tell me, I am never going to sell that jet to Venus, but you don't ever get out of it. You know, whereas today, it's mostly the heat pumps they're selling.
So what's the delivery of the hot water heater heat pump?
What do you mean?
Well, is supply chain a problem? I mean, like you said, it's an emergency. I'm well aware of taking cold showers. So if you have a long delivery for a heat pump, a water heater.
So they've both been affected by supply chain issues that they had the past year, which are a little unusual. Now, other than that, you know, there aren't no major supply chain issues. It's just more of a question of comfort, you know, that they themselves have to feel like, you know, I really want to sell this thing. And try to explain to the customer, why are you going to pay a little bit more today if you're going to pay less over the next 12 years? You know, that whole conversation, you know, they don't necessarily want to engage with it. They just want to install. And then also some of the heat, you know, it's somewhat nominal, but on the heat pump water heater, oftentimes the water supplies are side of the tank instead of on top of the tank, so there's some more plumbing that needs to be done, you know. In the grand scheme of things, that's nominal, but, you know, if you have a business where your job is to, like, bang out a couple of heat pumps or a couple of water heaters a day, get on to the next job, and you don't ever have to want to return doing that maintenance for the job, you know. So largely, what I figure is we have a rebate, we offer it, I talk to them, but I don't try to run them about it. And over time, I'm assuming manufacturer, you know, through their support will help that turn around. You know? Where we find ourselves in a position where we're not meeting the target, I may, you know, sort of think about increasing the rebates for those, but I wouldn't want to do that right now, even though it's fairly slow, because, you know, meeting the targets, exceeding the targets at a very low cost. So,
that would be fun and interesting if somebody figures out how to take the cold air coming off of a hot water heat pump and force it into the front end of your refrigerator freezer. It's because you're taking your heat, your house temperature at 68, cooling it down the refrigerator. Meantime, the heat pump is doing the reverse.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. So my projection is for 2022-2023, you know, we're probably going to exceed the target, and we'll do that at a very low cost. And so in summary, the 2021 target of net have been met. And I should add, those numbers haven't been audited by the state auditor yet. The auditing process will start this summer, but given how much we overshot the target, I feel quite confident that will build up. Yeah, energy and PEMSAT compliance, you know, it's relatively cheap so far in the systems that it has merged with CETA, helping build to the future, but for 2022-2023, I expect us to meet the target at a low cost.
You know, we had a lot of discussion.
Sorry. I just said good job.
Yeah, good job. A lot of discussion of pancaking EIA on the CBA. And that's still going on as far as I know.
Well, yeah, sort of the EIA is kind of integrated with CBA. Yeah, for instance, when we did our clean energy implementation plan, you know, technically the way rules are written, we're also supposed to do conservation potential assessment for that clean energy implementation plan. But the, since we've already done that, we just reference it. You know, and I expect us to continue like that. It's just a little different for the smaller utilities because, you know, the small utilities have been subjected to the Energy Independence Act, but they are subject to the Clean Energy Implementation Plan, you know, which is not part of the
Thank you.
China, things to me like this might be an opportunity to get some publicity in the paper. I mean, setting conservation targets and then exceeding them seems to me as a good list that we should toot our horn about. Like through a press release or something?
Yeah.
Or I'm not sure how you get something out there, but it seems to me like this is a good story to tell. That, you know, we've set targets, we're going to the conservation important to us, and not only have we met, but we've exceeded our targets. And I don't know, it seems like a good deal, a good story to me.
Sure. Yeah, me and Matthias and Nicole can work on the press release.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So, thank you.
Good job.
Our next item is material shortages, delays, and costs. Well, that sounds pretty heavy, John.
Well, yes.
Sorry.
I wish I had good news like the tire pad, but as you may be aware, the district has been hit over the last couple of years with chronic supply chain issues and now high cost escalations. And this is true for pretty much almost all of the materials we use. So that, for instance, you can see there's, you know, electrical conductors, cable wire, most of the electrical devices, breakers, section wires, even fuses, equipment, and special purpose vehicles, the lead times are greatly extended for all the buckets purposes in order. But the biggest problem for us is distribution transformers. That's a commodity item, or at least we thought of it. So we have 8,000 of them in our system now. And we typically procure at least a couple hundred a year, sometimes it's 300 a year. Right now, orders are regularly being pushed out far beyond the dates quoted. And I think Sean sent email to commissioners on 323, advising that we're completely out of 25 kidney transport paths. Probably the most common item in our system now for new construction. This is resulting in extensive delays in providing service to new customers across the area if it involves a transformer. And the problem is industry wide. We see messages every day. So the homeowners help us, Clark help us. Most utilities have exhausted some of the inventory.
John, most of our larger transformers are utility-based, right? Is that true?
Yeah, our power transformers, we have different markets, some of them overseas. We even have to have the U.S. name on it, so to speak. Most of the distribution transformers we still get domestically, at least for manufacturing purpose. they import almost all the raw materials, the aluminum, transformer cores, a lot of those are being brought up from overseas. Okay, so give an idea of what's going on. Orders for transformers initiated last year for receipt this year. Keep in mind, we got 52-week lead times of stuff we ordered last year. That's crazy for us. We're paying 75% increases over historical prices from 21 to 22. Lead times that used to be 16 to 18 weeks are pushed out to 66 weeks. It's crazy now. The March 22 quotes for 2023 delivered, we have, with this pointer working, a 300% increase over a 75% increase. Wow. Okay, so for a 25 KVA transport pad that we're paying $1,200, the quotes are $10,000. $10,000. It's crazy. Last quote, 66-month minimum. Evidently, the negative pandemic impacts are far worse than anticipated. We expected to be coming out of this. We're not. I also say I call it an industry panic because this is everywhere. People are actually paying these dollars for transport. Okay, so prior to 2021, our transformer budget for distribution transformers and regulators was typically $750,000 a year. 2023, if these numbers hold up, 75% increases, we're looking at $5 million per year in distribution transformers. That's a 6% rate impact. Now, keep in mind, we saw the increase in the unit cost. Transformers are capitalized upon receipts. They don't go into rates. They're not reflected in the unit cost. When we set a transformer, we charge them the cost of the pad, or the grounding system, the ball storage transformers. We don't charge them the material cost of the transformer. Those eventually get factored into rates. And that 6% rate increase impact is just through distribution transformers, not conduit, not several insulated connectors for cable systems, not overhead wire, not poles. It's just distribution transformers. It's a capacity. Okay, other than not being able to get transformers, and when you do get the pay exorbitant cost for them, we're taking some mitigating actions to try to minimize the consequences. Everything we can think of. Okay, so for specifications, we, on the latest order we're going out for, we moved the stainless steel requirements for transformer cases. That might be a specialty item that's elevated cost for us specifically. We removed the type of heat required for transformers. When a heat pump starts, because the bolts are stiff, we specified historically the last 20 years, transformers with long peaks. Because of that special requirement, which we used to pay a $100 or $200 premium, we don't know what the premium is now. It may be $1,000, maybe $2,000. It's definitely increasing the lead time. So basically, we've abandoned those specialty requirements for our transformers. Of course, if we use them all still and put them out near the water, it's going to rust out. That's why we won't stand the same as fish.
Charge a lot for the grist water.
Yeah, so basically, the premium we're paying now, we expect, is much more than the benefit we'll receive in 20 years. Number one, we're trying to get transfers. And I'd say this will incur future costs, but it'll only be a fraction of what we're paying now. Really on cost of transformers. We're also making an effort to return all I-25 KVA cat transformers to stock for use. Now we got 18,000 transformer system. Not all of them are being used, some of them have been idle for a couple of 3 or 4 years. We're going back to taking a hard look at that. Late last year, we removed all radio band transformers. have been a crash course contract. We brought them into stock. We've been using them as well as exhaust. We're now going to start retrieving 50 to 60 transformers that have no load on them, but they're being used as junctions. Think of a subdivision where you have radial chain transformers, and you have lots and a lot of lots not developed. Now they're vacant. They don't have customers. But when the subdivision was put in several years back, they installed, let's say, 4 or 5 transformers in a row. Now we're going to look at pulling some of those transformers out, bringing them back to stock, and then putting in a junction for the cable. Now, this means you might have to go back out and return them to service if you get a customer application, but at least bring us transformers and not pay $10,000 for a $1,400 transformer. The problem with that is going to cost customer outages. Since it's not the dead end to remove those transformers, we have to de-energize the line, take the transformer out, and then put a portable feature device to tie the cable back. So that's going to be letting people fly. You can have a number of 10-minute outages. That's going to happen a lot.
But the outages are just wider.
Yeah, so basically, we opened the fuse cutout on the riser, get down to this radio room, let's say. We de-energize it, we isolate it, you know, do all the Washington Department's clearances. We disconnect and pull the transformer.
Okay, I got it. Yeah. It's not multiple outages per customer, it's one outage per customer.
Yeah, well, it is to pull one transformer cause an outage for all customers on that brand.
Yeah, that's a one time.
And also when you go back and install.
Sure. So, yeah.
So one now and one in the future. It won't be a whole lot of customers affected at one time. We're also going to give the option for customers who need service. Where we normally put a pantograph transformer in an underground subdivision. If the governing authority allows us to do it, the county, SWIM, once they're pulling an overhead transformer, we'll have an underground primary pulling the transformer, secondary down to be another for that customer. They need power, and if that power is sometimes the best on where they're going to be able to do it. We're also going to repair and repurpose any transformer coming in. We used to surplus those that had broken bushings or if they're badly rusted. We're probably going to refresh them, replace the bushings, test them, and get them back out to service. We're also going to look at projects out there where we have 2 25 kVA transformers in close proximity. We're going to try to bring those back, install a 50 and run a secondary cable to one of the pad sites and feed those that previously came from a 25 kVA. We still have the number of 50 kVA transformers, and that we're going to keep that for every 50 kVA transformer sitting out. And we're making an effort to communicate this short spot transition is affecting us and all the utilities. The people requesting the service. And as commissioners, you're going to hear about this soon, have not already. People have been very patient, but their patience is not right. You're going to get a phone call, man, no doubt. In conclusion, the current transport situation is unprecedented. As far as I know, it's never happened like this in the parks, rather than just the transport. These mitigation efforts will require a substantial amount of work effort, so on behalf of work, we might spend as much as $1 million in labor to do all this to avoid a $4 million plus expensive transformers postponed. We'll try to avoid paying high costs and what we hope is a transitory phenomenon interest panic. But I will caution, this is one of the things, if you think about it, with how these things go through the economy, the national inflation and potential recessionary implications associated with this supply chain issue are immense. It will have significant negative impacts on the local and national economy. Just think about it. We can't provide power to a business that's trying to open up. We're dead in the water. And everyone else in the country is. So, John, how many customers are waiting right now that can't put electricity into their new house? We have 30 something transformers that are waiting for a business or a customer power. And we cannot start it now. And that's 30, is it? 30, yes. It's going to get worse. We have a, we'll have 100 service requests this month.
But if somebody comes in now, we tell them that was 2 or 3 years.
No, we tell them we can't. You know, we have an order of transformers, 50 something. So it's like, one on 50, one on smaller now. They're originally scheduled in November of last year. And then they changed the delivery to March. And in March, they changed the delivery to May. Whether they're going to get here in May or not, I don't know. If we get them in May, we'll have transformers for a few months.
Yeah, I'm surprised we're not getting a bunch of phone calls.
Yeah, well, the customers that we can't give you power because transformers are not available. We tell them, well, we were telling them that they're scheduled to arrive in March, and they didn't. But all the service men, engineering, ready to communicate with the customer. Scope of the project, and they're giving them information so that they know that it's not just us saying so. I'm hoping with some of what we're offering, a pole or a transformer, if you really need power, maybe you can live with a pole and all that transformer, and I would have that transformer if it makes a difference in getting power now or some unknown power.
A lot of neighborhoods require all underground utilities. And not the transformers and all that. So they have to approach those homeowners and say, you know, this has at least temporarily changed.
Yeah, so basically, you know, most of the poor will go to swim where they require underground. That's all we can't provide underground. Can we do a pole and a transformer? You have a customer, a potential property taxpayer, who can't move in because we don't have a transformer. And I think, you know, probably. And well received from the jurisdictions like this.
So you try to mitigate the impact of this, but financially, is what's the net results?
Right now, the impact on the transformers order last year and this year is less than $500,000. And those are for the transformers we received in May, instead of $1,300, we're going to be paying $2,200, $2,300. That's not that bad yet. But when we go to budget for 23, if this isn't over, we're going to have to blow up at least, even if all this works, it's going to be a couple million dollars more than anticipated. So basically, everyone's panicked. And we have utilities, Clickcat, ran into this. Their board says, go out and buy 2 or 3 years worth of transport. What's that going to do for us?
Maybe if it's going to make it worse.
So the homeless, the same thing. The homeless is begging for transformers, cable, certain wire styles. Is whatever reason the pandemic issues are not being ready. Now, I'm at a loss why. Most of the manufacturing was not shut down that much. The demand is picked up, but not so much as in all of this. I think part of this is manufacturers or distributors taking advantage.
So it's price gouging.
Well, I'm not going to say that. That's one potential. But everyone is doing it. We're hearing the horror stories. We're going to do what we can to mitigate it for the near term.
But yeah, I would assume that this should be a short term issue.
I would think so because the prices are that high when people increase manufacturing. They start rewinding old transformers using ports. It takes a while for that to ramp up. I'm hoping maybe by the end of the year, this is coming back down a little bit. But it makes no sense.
Because if nothing else, you also get other people getting into the business.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, worst comes to worst, maybe we'll buy transformers, or we might not buy transformers. Results in not quite the same reliability, but still pay. You do not pay $10,000 for a 25 ticket transformer.
Like it will take care of itself.
And of course, sir, you may not get it. That's all. Thanks, John.
Thank you. Okay, thanks, John. You're doing a great job there.
Well, I'd like to take the credit for engineering operations. They've been working on this since the fall. Because it's got to the point that it's beyond our control.
Pass on our conversation with her.
Yeah, I know Mike at engineering and the service that have been doing a good job communicating with the customers and handling those complaints. We've been handling them internally, but like John said, some of the customers' patience is about to wear out.
Oh, yeah, you can understand.
Oh, yeah.
And that's starting to grow, too.
Yeah.
It does.
And it's making us livelihoods.
Yeah, exactly.
And part of the problem is that when a customer applies for new service, they come in and they pay for that up front. So we're holding on to their money to save their spot in line, which, you know, is another frustration for them.
Right. Is there, given this unprecedented situation, is there the potential for us to reduce the amount that they have to put down since there's such a lengthy time for them to wait?
We've had internal discussions about not even charging them at all, but part of the problem is that if we don't charge, our experience has been that we'll get a bunch of requests that will never come to fruition.
Now, that's why I don't think maybe it's zero, but maybe since there is such a long lead time, 80% or something.
Well, at some point, I think we should take the money, and at some point it becomes too long. We fund a partial and keep it positive, keep it in the line, something like that.
Either that or pay interest or something. It doesn't feel right to take that much money and keep it for a year and a half. And
yeah, it makes us look like that.
Yeah, yeah. But when you take that deposit, you're getting in line and buying transformers and all the other stuff, so there is a cost associated with
that. Yeah, there is.
Yeah, I don't think we get to zero. Make sure we cover our costs, but I don't know, just because
I know, like, we've gone out, most of these cases, we've gone out and done all the work, like, all the infrastructure there, we're just making the transformer.
Yeah, a lot of times we build the conduit runs,
yeah,
the path size, just working on the transformer.
Okay, other questions, discussion on that issue? John's got some more bad news for us.
Yeah, this is just a messenger here. As you're probably aware, on April 4th, Monday, about 6 p.m. a little after, we experienced a DPA transmission outage. So basically, what happened was the sectionalizer, 1478 Silverado, opened up, put in the west end out. We also had another outage in the Transport of Joyce area. One of our distribution feeders, as well as other outages. The big outage was about 5,600 customers out west in your bank seat. We did have, when you have a west end outage in our current configuration, we can also impact any customer in the various corner of Joyce, about 2,500 customers. We're subject to drop and pick restoration outages. The long absence of outgas.
Is there any update to the loop those systems?
Oh, for Joyce and Silverado, they are moved from EPA. That was the whole purpose of the transmission. Yeah. Rebuild. Once we get beyond Joyce, going out west, there's no way. Okay, about an hour later, 7 o'clock, we get a Port Anson's operator, who is in Montgomery. And given a distance read of about 23 miles from Port Anson's, and that corresponded to a location about 5 miles to the west of Silverado. Now, a distance read is a relay calculation that, based on the phase-to-phase, phase-to-ground current and fault current, gives an estimation of where the fault is located. Now, there's some impedance issues by tree goes to the line, but a distance ring is not always accurate. It's generally accurate about 60 to 70% of the time. They tell you where it is, go out to that location, fault is a tree in the line. There's a line down. But it's not always accurate.
So when we got that information over, when they told us that information, they also told us that the BPA crew is going to be in ground with 3-hour transit time to get out to the Silverado now. It's a lot quicker to get to Swim, but it's going to still a lot more to get to Point of Trouble, either the Logging Roads or the east or the west clear. It takes them a little bit longer, but they get a 3-hour BPA arrival cruise. Because of that delay, we have Michigan Patrol Silverado going out towards out west. We had a couple guys looking at it. They have to go in and out, folks back out, back in. And we got to about 7, almost 8 miles, and we have to stop and patrol. So the distance rate from this location is incorrect. Or at least if it's correct, it cleared itself. After that, we had a lot of trouble on our system, both having boards and the PA joint area. Two crews were out taking care of problems under the PA office. And the joint area, there's 4 hours of doors we had not stand in the market. We had a crew taking care of that. At the same time, we had a poor fault and terror. So we had to deal with that as well. So, a little after 10 p.m., the BPA commenced their patrol on the 4-mile section of Silverado Sapro. And their patrol was completed about 3:30 a.m. with no trouble found. And the West End was restored about 4 a.m. So basically, a lot of times we have transmission out, but sometimes we have it. The tree hits the line, causes the breaker to trip, the tree falls to the ground, and the line is clear and ready for service. By policy, both BPA and the PVD do not energize long enough lines without control due to safety concerns. So you do something hot, make it hot, and you have a patrol, then you get a line that's no car, or car call, or somebody at the point of the patrol and energize, you don't have to. So that would be all required by and our community. So it's very likely to be contacted the line from the distance we indicated. We didn't see any fall trees, but it's likely them or something there. 1478 opened. Tree or the limb moved clear. When they do a patrol of the weekend line, it's 24 miles, no one exercise. The roads you have to travel is 48 miles, and when you flip the back and forth, going to the end, back around, is close to 66 miles. That's generally no speed, so the time it took them to patrol was not really that unusual, very typical. So, once again, I said we had 3 mile hours, we had 4 crews out at some point in time. Most of the crews got in well before midnight, when the crews finished up to about 7 a.m. So we did take a note from America down, maybe one of the EPA, and talking to them about our houses compared to their houses. We have up to out, we have, of course, houses for any customer in the system. The city PA and Jefferson would be next, but we're the ones that have that line going out to Sapple. For that reason, we're going to be far worse. Well, we'll pay BPA specifically about that. Now, a couple of years ago, they did do a major tree trimming, tree clearance project, removing close to 1,000 trees because of the problem for that. Hoping that mitigated things for at least several years, but you know, actually, they have something like this. I think last meeting, or maybe the meeting before last, Jim, you requested that we also include the statistics for BPA outages on our outages, and we'll be reporting that to the board of the KPIs. In many respects, sometimes some of these BPA outage minutes, or customer minutes, six hours.
We've been working this issue for years, and not making a lot of it at the bottom of it. So anything contractually, we would fall back on.
It is a challenge. It actually helps customers complain to us.
interact there. They're not used to dealing with customers like we are. So it's kind of a hot potato for them, excellent couple. I want to say the last time when we did a pretty far, when they turned so many trees out, it got very high level. They were really concerned about what was going on. Then they heard to go out and find them. Normally I wait until a specific incident occurs that we can point to, that we can mitigate, it's a smart material that's out. The tree branch or tree in the line fell out, so it's kind of hard to say it's shipped up something else. In the past, we talked about spacing and crew here. They're very opposed to that, that's the pain and cost. We have talked to them about doing more and about doing patrols, that has to help us. They go to where we find lots of trouble, that helps. Sometimes we have work to do in our systems, sometimes that's a plus, sometimes it's not. Even if there's nothing wrong, the best we're going to do on DKI is not a, we've never had a DKI, it's a best thing, it's best in that.
Jesse, is that it?
I don't know.
Well,
3 hours transit, 5 or 6 hours of patrol. You can't get around if you're on your options and driving in the light. And I guess we can push that, but I'd rather not.
Great. Thank you, John. Any board action items.
I think we have another.
I didn't realize this, but the snow actually hit Calhoun, Lewis, and Clark counties pretty good last night. And we got a request this morning from Calhoun for mutual aid assistance. They had quite a few of their substations down, so we sent a crew out this morning to transit down there and work until they're ready to fight for the next day or two.
How much snow did they get?
It's like 8 inches, wasn't it, John? I think they got 8 inches. It was 10. So it took out a lot of trees. And then
the daughter down in Oregon got snow. But it was the first time in 80 years that snow was this time of year.
Yeah. But it's heavy like that, it's just.
Oh, yeah, 80 inches.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
yeah.
We have a few board action items for staff. There's the request that Assistant General Manager John Hurd to report on a business plan to accommodate excessive new growth as a result of electric vehicle charging. And the other item is to reach out to Big Gary and ask them to provide with the outage time by utility for their customers in order to possibly provide us with some less leverage. In regards to EPA servicing of transmission outages on the Lemon Peninsula.
And then a press release with Nicole about the conservation.
Probably some more quick statements. I have to stop doing
it. What happens to you? Oh, I want to hear it. Okay, next item is comments from the public. Nicole, can you see the hands up?
If anybody would like to make public comments, please use the raise hand function.
What about in chat?
Oh, we have left on in the chat at this point.
Okay. All right, we do not have an executive session, so let's go over to the stuff for the board. Standards are thank you to everyone.
So, do you think anything we want out of these? I took out the letter to Doug and this.